Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
The American Legislative Exchange Council has been under attack. Liberals have been challenging its role in developing laws in many states. They question its status as a tax-exempt charity. The conference is behind closed doors. So to start, what is this meeting about?
This is where ALEC does its heavy lifting on legislation. It has task forces on civil justice and education and things like that.
That is a little excerpt from a National Public Radio story filed earlier this year about an ALEC meeting in another state. You don't have to go far to hear about the American Legislative Exchange Council, and Utahns have been and will be bombarded with stories about ALEC as the organization gathers for its national convention in Salt Lake City next Wednesday through Saturday. So I thought we'd spend a little bit of time talking about ALEC, its programs, and the controversy in some respects. A couple of different perspectives. First of all, we're pleased to have with us State Representative Bradley Daw, Republican of Orem and a member of ALEC, who I assume will be attending a lot of the sessions this week. Representative Daw, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. Appreciate that.
Let me just first quote from the ALEC website about what the organization is. This is their wording. The American Legislative Exchange Council works to advance the fundamental principles of free market enterprise, limited government, and federalism at the state level through a nonpartisan public-private partnership of America's state legislators. Does that sound like the organization you know?
Yeah, it does, very much so.
Well, tell me more about that, your experiences with ALEC.
You know, my experiences primarily as a legislator are when we go to these ALEC conferences is the opportunity for me is to rub shoulders with legislators from other states. I find that, for me personally, to be the most productive part of it, to discuss policies with them, see what's working in their states, and realize that, conservatism isn't just a Utah phenomenon. Not that I ever really believed that, but it's always nice to get confirmation and to see what kind of ideas are coming from my colleagues in other states. So that to me is the most useful aspect of ALEC.
Well, you rub shoulders with other lawmakers and with representatives of business as well.
A little bit, but not quite so much. It is primarily with other lawmakers from other states. The business interests are there, and they do some lobbying, but honestly, my focus has always been to discuss policy and so forth with lawmakers from other states. So that really, I can't speak for all legislators, but that really becomes my focus and what I get out of ALEC.
I should mention for our listeners, this is a live conversation. If you have a question or comment, you can join us on the phone at 1-800-826-1495 or send an email to us at upraccess@gmail.com. State Representative Bradley Daw, our guest. First, so they open Wednesday at noon with a keynote address or comments by Governor Herbert, and then later on you break up into panels. Describe for me kind of the structure of the conference.
Well, basically, the way the conferences work is we'll have our breakfast and our lunch together, and that's where we'll have speakers from different areas, and obviously they'll address a variety of topics. And then we'll break up into task forces, and I'm on the Health and Human Services Task Force, as well as being on the Health and Human Services Executive Committee. And the task forces primarily will consider model legislation. That's legislation that the legislators, if they choose to, can take back to their states and run there if they would like to do so. And so our job as a task force is to vet and approve or reject proposed model legislation.
Are any of the sessions open to the press?
Yeah, I believe so. In fact, most of them are. In fact, I don't believe there's any. I think possibly the executive committee, where we're just planning the meeting, may not be. But as I understand it, I've never not seen a task force session where press wasn't present.
Because that is one of the criticisms, and that actually is a major point for me as a representative of the press, is an opportunity to actually watch these discussions.
Oh, I understand. I understand that. And like I say, as I understand it, the press is invited to the task force sessions, but you know, that's been my understanding.
So have you, as a state legislator, been able to take advantage of some of these models that are developed in ALEC workshops and bring proposals to Utah, to the state legislature?
Me specifically, no. In fact, I've actually proposed some model legislation, but there's other states that have beat me to the punch. So a lot of what's happening at ALEC we've already done here in Utah, and so I'm able to comment on what's going on. In some cases. Now, there has been some model legislation that has been run here, one dealing with product liability from the Criminal Justice Task Force, and then there was one, I believe, the opt-out of Obamacare run by Representative Wimmer started with as a piece of ALEC model legislation. So other legislators have. I haven't seen any specifically, primarily because on the Health and Human Services Task Force, Utah tends to be ahead of the curve.
There was reference in the Salt Lake Tribune to a 2009 bill that you sponsored on voter identification, which I guess wasn't, but became an ALEC bill.
You know, that may have been an ALEC bill, but I didn't get that from ALEC specifically. In fact, that actually was started by Representative Lockhart. And then, you know, since she was in a leadership position, she tries to dump off those, and so she handed that to me. So I actually got it from her. Whether or not it was an ALEC model bill, I wasn't aware of at the time.
As you know, Representative, there are critics of ALEC, and they will be out in force during the conference and other locations around Salt Lake City. I think one organization, we're going to hear from them a little later, put up a billboard. And we don't have much time, but I'd like you to just have a chance to address the critics of ALEC, what you hear them saying and how you would respond.
I'd be happy to. Do you want me to address specific criticism?
Oh, wait.
General?
I'll give you the quick rundown, that it's pay to play, it's corporate funded, it's kind of secretive, it gets people with the moneyed interest more access to lawmakers than average citizens have. One of the model bills had to do with the gun issue that led to the shooting death in Florida, those sorts of things.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't address that one specifically. I mean, that one seems to be a little bit odd. But frankly, a pay-to-play, well, I have to pay out of my own campaign account if I want to attend ALEC. In fact, it's one of the organizations that doesn't use any taxpayer money that I'm aware of. And so it's pay to pay by legislators more than anything else. In other words, if I want to be a member of it, I have to pay the dues. There is some corporate sponsorships there. Does that give them more access? As I said before, we do have task forces where they do have input, but basically the only real input they have is if they don't like a piece of model legislation, they can vote against it, just like if we don't like a piece, we can vote against it. So a model bill has to be approved by both the private and the public sector. And if neither, you know, unless both of them approve it, it's not made into a model legislation. So to me, it's a partnership between those who are in the industry and those who are in the public sector trying to regulate the industry. So, you know, is that a additional collusion? To me, it's a filtering process where only legislation that's going to benefit both parties would pass muster. So I kind of like the idea of a higher bar for model legislation. As far as specifics on gun legislation, I without really knowing the details of that, I really couldn't comment. But
yeah, that was the one called Stand Your Ground.
Oh, okay. That's where if you're defending your property, you ought to be able to use a firearm if you're defending your life or your property. Does that sound right?
Yeah, and the criticism was that led to the shooting, and that was a model ALEC piece of legislation. And, you know, it does seem to stray kind of out of the mainstream of some of the issues you would expect the group to be talking about.
You know, that's interesting. I would never consider somebody being able to defend themselves as out of the mainstream. I kind of always thought that was an American ideal, was being able to exercise the right to keep and bear arms and defend your property and your life. How that deals with the specifics in Florida, I would have to look at that. But I certainly don't consider self-defense a fringe issue.
Do you know how many people are expected next week?
Well, let's see. Typical ALEC attendees, I think, is on the order of 2,000, but that's just kind of a ballpark guess.
So it's a big deal.
It is a big deal. You know, to me, it's a real opportunity to meet with my colleagues from other states and get to know what's going on in their states and see what good ideas they have, and maybe they could take a few good ideas from Utah home to their states as well.
Well, we'll let you go. Leave it there. Our guest, State Representative Bradley Daw, is a Republican legislator from Orem, and will be attending the ALEC conference next Wednesday through Saturday in Salt Lake City. Representative Bradley, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks. And as we say, there are critics of ALEC, and you will hear a lot from them, especially as we get into the conference next week. One of them is Marianne Martindale, and she is executive director of the Alliance for Better Utah. They had booked space in Little America Hotel to offer information that sort of contradicts with positions taken by ALEC, and they learned that they actually ran into an exclusivity clause in ALEC's contract, so they're not going to be there. I'm sure they have other spaces as well. And we do have Marianne Martindale with us on the line right now. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me just start with that first story. You got kicked out of Little America.
Yeah, we did. We had secured some meeting space, and this was just, you know, regular ground floor meeting space, just as any other company would go in and, like, to have a private function or whatever. And we had no intentions of having anything disruptive. It was purely an informational, a place where we could meet with the press, where we could hold meetings, things like that. And after we had secured that, we were waiting on the contract and doing some follow-up with them, and heard a couple of, about 10 days after we had secured the space, that we would not, in fact, be allowed to have space there, that ALEC had an exclusivity portion of their contract that allowed that basically if any group came in and the way they worded it, if any group tried to rent space, that group had to be run past ALEC first, and they had the right to refuse them space. And we were turned down because of that.
Have you found other space?
We did. We actually have secured a space on State Street, 629 South State. We rented an empty storefront. We felt like it was the proximity was great. Actually gives us a little bit more flexibility in terms of, you know, times that we use it and freedom to kind of do what we want with the space. So we will be holding public meetings there, press conferences and so forth. We're actually having a public workshop on the night of the 25th at 6 p.m. To help educate the public. We have a lot of national and local speakers that are coming to that to really educate the public. I mean, ALEC, it's a complicated issue. You know, legislation is not, you know, they always talk about it, so, you know, no one wants to see how sausage is made. I mean, it is a little bit like that. It's kind of wonky. So we figured this is a good way to digest it down and into pieces and issues that are more easily understood by the general public.
You also bought a billboard?
Yes, we did. Again, you know, education is really, you know, our push behind this. We really want people to understand what it is. So we have a couple of billboards around the state, as well as we have some statewide digital billboards that just essentially say ALEC is coming, and then drive them to a website, speakuputah.org, which is on our site, that has some informational, ALEC information on it.
Let me just, and I'll follow up with some specifics, but what's your general concern about having 2,000 people gather at a conference in Salt Lake City and talk about legislative issues?
You know, there's a couple of different concerns. I mean, ideological or philosophical concerns aside, the lack of transparency is really concerning to us. So, you know, you'll have occasionally a legislator, Kurt Bramble, for example, you know, tries to say, no, you know, it's public, it's open, all these things. Well, it's not. If I had $7,000, $12,000, $25,000, I could possibly buy access to that. But as we saw with Little America, they also have the ability to shut us out. So if we don't agree with them, they're not necessarily going to let us just walk in the door. You know, the public isn't included in these meetings. So you have legislators sitting in the room with other legislators, which collaboration is great. None of us are saying that we think legislators should be drafting bills in a cave, you know, alone without any kind of interaction with other legislators, because collaboration that makes for good legislation. But they also happen to be in the room with a whole bunch of corporate lobbyists that have paid upwards of $25,000 to be sitting in that room, and those doors are closed, and the public has no idea what the conversations are. We have no idea what legislation comes out of there that is being proposed, who's proposing it, who's benefiting from that legislation. And, you know, we have a very short legislative window. We have 45 days, 33 actual working days. And during that time, there's some 800 to 900 bills that are proposed. It's next to impossible to figure out exactly what the point is behind a lot of those bills. And, you know, you rely on your legislature to tell you there's nothing that requires them to say that these are ALEC model legislation, where they got the ideas for the bills, who it is, if there are corporations that are actually going to financially benefit by these bills. And we find that really problematic.
Well, I asked Representative Bradley Daw specifically, and maybe it was his guess, but would the press be allowed into the workshops? And he said, yeah, they're open.
No, that's contrary to what the press has told us. So we've had press that had applied for credentials for this and were turned down. So, in past, and that's been typical of the last couple of ALEC conferences as well, is that they have not allowed the press inside. I'm sure the press will try, and they certainly should, because, you know, that's one thing, to keep people out of it, to keep us in the cold in it, it's contrary to a Utah value. I mean, we saw a year ago Utahns stand up very strongly against HB 477, which was an attempt to close the public out of finding out, you know, important information. And this is just another step in that same thing. I mean, it's really the closed-door meetings, the lack of transparency, the shadowy meeting between lobbyists and legislators, I mean, that really is contrary to what we believe Utahns want and expect.
We're speaking with Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of the Alliance for Better Utah. Earlier, we were speaking with Representative Bradley Daw, talking about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Meeting's going to be in Salt Lake next Wednesday through Saturday. We have about 10 minutes left. If you have a question, feel free to join the conversation. 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email to upraccess@gmail.com. Well, as you mentioned, talking about the bill-making process can get a little wonky. Let's talk about issues. Give me some examples of where the effect of having these meetings take place between lobbyists and legislators have led to bad policy.
Well, you mentioned when you were speaking with Representative Daw, you mentioned the Stand Your Ground bill. That's something that we've actually had that in Utah for a very long time, and not every bill, you know, comes out exactly the same, but that's an issue that we've seen nationally. It certainly brought a lot of exposure on ALEC, far more than I think that they had hoped or expected. But with the shooting of Trayvon Martin, that gained a much different look on whether those bills were actually providing a safety for the person carrying or a means to carry out violence against another person who may or may not have posed a threat. And, you know, Representative Doss stated that he thought, I mean, and it was clear he didn't really have a lot of understanding on it, so I'm not going to go after him too hard for not knowing all the nuance of that particular argument. You know, that bill was the one in Florida is particularly open in that it allows someone, even if they're, they think they're threatened, even if the person isn't necessarily displaying overtly threatening behavior, to take a more aggressive action. Our bill, as I understand it, here is not quite that lax. But, you know, there's a concern with that. No one's trying to take away anyone's guns. I don't think anyone that's standing up against some of these Stand Your Ground laws is saying that, you know, the Second Amendment is not a valid part of the Constitution and that people shouldn't have guns. It's just that, you know, where does that line, where do we draw that line between when you actually are protecting your home, your property, your family, or when you're actually becoming the aggressor? And I think that that's, you know, that's a distinction that we're still trying to find in this country. You know, we do like our guns, and there's nothing wrong with owning guns, but it's also a great deal of responsibility to carry. And, you know, we have a very open, very lax concealed carry permit here. Last year we saw the removal of the 1,000-foot ban for carrying guns to schools. I mean, things like that I think are concerning. It's when we start making them very lax, and that's what a lot of the focus has been on this, and that's very much an ALEC agenda. You know, privatization of education has also been a very big thing, and that's something that we've seen in Utah. In 2007, the legislature passed the voucher bill, which was resoundingly overturned in a public referendum, after which the legislature changed the rules of referendums. So it's, you know, it's like they don't, it seems that they don't really like to be questioned. But, you know, who is really benefiting from that? There's a lot of argument on both sides about how that really, can that help or does that hurt public education? And, you know, who benefits from that other than private industry, private corporations, private schools? And so it's when you start, you know, we're certainly not against corporations or free enterprise or any of that. It's just you need to balance what's going on with the state, what's needed for the state, what things we really do, what infrastructure we still need to keep in place versus what we offsource or outsource to corporate private enterprise that's actually essentially just turning around and making money off of that.
Now, what they will say is regardless of where the bills come from, they have to go first to the legislative attorney, and then they come for public hearings, and then they get debated and generally in both floors of the legislature. There are plenty of opportunities for public involvement. Bill's ideas come from all over the place, and why shouldn't supporters of ALEC have that same right?
Well, they should, but it should be done in the public. I mean, I should have the right to be able to go and sit in the back of these meetings. You know, even if I'm not a member and I can't speak or whatever, fine, but I should be able to watch what's happening. I should be able to see which corporate lobbyists are sitting next to my legislators and understand which kinds of things so that then when I do look at the bills, I'm more informed. I'm able to actually understand who might be benefiting from that. You know, it's that lack of trust. It's as soon as the door closes, you know, there's a veil of secrecy that comes over that then just enhances that public lack of trust in their elected leaders. And I think that if I were a legislator, I would be going just the opposite. I would be opening the door as much as possible to allow people to see how this is happening, because you why would you not want people to understand where these are coming from? If they're proud of their membership in ALEC, then acknowledge that on the bills, just like they should if it's coming from NCSL or CSG or some of these other organizations, or if a constituent has suggested it. There's nothing that requires bills to be identified, and I think that's concerning. Again, going back to the 800 or 900 bills in our 45 days. Plus, you know, let's not forget we can protect bills here. So a bill can have a bill file and have a name, but there's no text required until 2 weeks prior to the end of the session. That bill file may actually be populated with text 24 hours prior to a committee meeting. So yes, while the system is in place that there is a public vetting, as it were, and it has to go to the House and it has to go to the Senate. I mean, then we have those steps in place. That also happens really quickly. We have a very truncated process for that. And so to expect people to be able to really absorb and understand what it is and ask the questions that they need to be asking in this little, you know, 24-hour window before a committee hearing, mm-hmm. and, you know, within days sometimes, or sometimes 48 hours, 72 hours, those bills are passed.
I think for me a key distinction here would be whether or not indeed some of these task force discussions are open to the press. I could understand the argument that the public doesn't get to get in free for a conference where people pay to register and attend, even though these are public officials. But if it is completely closed to the media, then I guess I would come down on the side of being quite concerned.
Yeah, and we checked into actually trying to see if we could pay to get in. There are three different levels where you can come in. You can come in as a private sector, which essentially means you are a corporate, a corporate or business owner and have a business interest. But we're talking thousands of dollars. This is not like pay $350 and go and sit in the back of a conference and get a free lunch. It's not like that. I mean, we're talking like $7,000, $9,000, $15,000, $25,000. I mean, it's a significant amount of money legislators pay $50 a year to belong. So there's an extremely disproportionate balance of first of all, who's paying to be a member. You know, you have corporations that pay, just like I said, you know, anywhere from $7,000 to $9,000 up to $25,000 to be members, but yet your legislators are paying $50 a year. And if I, as a citizen, wanted to try to get in there, assuming they would let me in, and I you know, from all indications is that they would not be inclined to, but if assuming they let me, I would still have to come up with almost $10,000 to go to this conference.
Finally, again, tell me what you, as executive director of your organization and others, will be doing next week.
So next Wednesday night, 6 o'clock at our site at 629 South State, we are holding an ALEC Exposed public workshop. We're asking people to RSVP just so we can, make sure that we have the capacity. If we maximize out, then we'll hold it a second night. So we have on our website, betterutah.org/ALEC-RSVP. You can sign up to attend this conference. We have national speakers. We have local speakers. We have League of Women Voters of Utah, Heal Utah, former Representative Cheryl Allen. We have Center for Media of Democracy, Common Cause. It's a really broad array, and we're trying to touch on not only the national perspective and what ALEC really is, but then also how it has affected Utahns, what kinds of bills we've seen here. And so it's going to be a very informative workshop for people, and I would really suggest if anyone's interested in it, you know, this is exactly where you're going to find out a lot more information, and then call your legislator. You know, be informed. Go with the right kind of information, the right questions to ask, and ask your legislator why they're a member, if they are indeed a member, and you know, really, really understand what it is and how it impacts your life.
By the way, finally, just in the interest of disclosure, which you're advocating, where does the Alliance for a Better Utah get the money to buy billboards and storefront space in Salt Lake?
Private donations. We are we have a C3 and a C4 status, which is pretty typical of most active nonprofits. So it really is just private donations. We don't have any really significant large donors. We have people who routinely give $15, $25 a month, as well as we have people who give a couple $1,000 or $500. I mean, just everything across the board. And it's really citizen-driven. So we ask donations of lists that we have, you know, our membership and so forth, and it's a variety.
And those names are publicly disclosed?
Well, they're disclosed as we have to with IRS regulations. So we file all of the necessary paperwork that we have to for both the C3 and the C4.
Well, it's going to be an interesting week, certainly, and do appreciate your spending some time with us, Mary Ann Martindale, Executive Director of the Alliance for a Better Utah, and with us earlier, State Representative Bradley Daw, and we have been talking about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and their national conference coming up next week, Wednesday through Saturday, in Salt Lake City. And thank you, Mary Ann, for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about wildfires in Utah.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
When I grow up, I want to be a weatherman. It's not that I want to be on the TV and stand in front of a map of North America and point out where the isobars are going to wreak havoc with the jet stream and enable the monsoon to swoop through and dump heavily on the southwest. Nah, I just think that it'd be reassuring to know that even if you're wrong 80% of the time, your boss wouldn't hold it against you. You see, down here in Los Cabos, we've been keeping a fairly close eye on the weather for a while now, and for a while now, it has been wrong. We've had rain and thunderstorms in the forecast at least 10 times the last month and haven't had a single drop yet. Some overcast, semi-cloudy, or is that partly cloudy, skies, but no rain. We're in hurricane season, and so far we've had 6 of them named, with the christening of Hurricane Fabio last week in the Pacific. But we still haven't had anything come remotely close to the shore, as most of them tighten up into fairly strong storms that turn due west, hundreds of miles south of us. And it may be a little strange, but a lot of us are hoping that at least one of those storms breaks loose a little closer to the peninsula. It's not that we're thrill seekers looking to test our mettle against Mother Nature. It's just that, well, we could really use rain because La Baja is into its fifth year of drought. Our hurricane season will continue until November 30th, so there is still plenty of time for one of those storms to send a little precipitation our way. Our best bet is in September, I'm told, when the offshore water is warm. I remember last summer when everybody got all excited because Hurricane Dora was heading our way. We were all sure that we would get a good bit of precipitation that would help recharge the aquifers and streams. All we got? Some big waves at the beach. The hardest rainfall we've had in more than a year came on the 4th of July last year when the heavens opened up for about a half an hour just as the fireworks were about to be launched. Besides the fishing and tourism industries, Baja California also has a lot of agribusiness, particularly on the western side of the peninsula where the temperatures are a little more moderate and there is a better water supply. Now, however, the first growing season of the year is over and all we're raising is dust, with forecasts for more of the same. But rain? There isn't a sign of it anywhere, which creates a real tropical depression around here. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
I can stand the rain. I can stand the rain.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the Weber State Cultural Affairs announcing their new season with performances by Bobby McFerrin, Jake Shimabukuro, and other details and ticket information is at wsuculturalaffairs.org.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in today for Tom Williams, who returns next week. And that was quite a coincidence, the Ed Casilia feature talking about rain, as we transition into a discussion now about the wildfire season in Utah, what has been happening, how people respond to wildfires, how resources are allocated, and what we can expect to happen the rest of the summer. And it's been quite a summer, with a couple of major blazes starting as early as June, way before we would expect a wildfire season to begin. We're pleased to have with us by phone live now Nick Howell, who is with the Bureau of Land Management Color Country District Office. And Nick, I'm just guessing you've been fairly busy.
Yeah, it's been extremely busy, especially over the last 2 months. We've been very busy.
Tell me, first of all, what is your exact title? I couldn't find that. I found a couple different references in some of the news stories.
Yeah, that's okay. My job title is Fire Mitigation and Education Specialist.
Well, that fits in, I think, with what we want to talk about here. And let me just ask you, if you have the information, where are we right now? Are there still a couple of fires burning, but we're not as bad as we were earlier?
Yeah, it's already been an extremely busy season, and it's kind of hard to say what's to come at this point. It's really a crapshoot. However, with that being said, I think we have seen the worst of it. But also, with that being said, there's a lot of fire season left. I would expect through September to still have a fair amount of fire activity, both lightning and human-caused fires, in addition, which will probably include the fire restrictions that are in effect right now.
Do you know where crews are deployed right now?
Yeah, we actually have crews all over the place. We have crews up in Idaho, as well as throughout Utah, still trying to make sure that the remaining wildfires within the state are under control and are not going to get back up and run again.
What's the biggest one right now in Utah?
The biggest one right now in Utah is probably down on the Arizona Strip. And that's actually part of our management area. It's not necessarily in the state of Utah, but it's in our management area. And it's just south of St. George. And it's around 35,000 acres right now. In addition to that, there is one in Utah that's pretty much contained, but crews are still staffing the fire right now. And that would be the Clay Springs Fire, which is about 5 miles south of Oak City, Utah. And I guess that fire not being super active at this point, it's around 97% contained, and it's around 107,000 acres.
I'll disclose a personal interest in the topic. I have a place down in Teesdale that I now spend about half my time at, and as you know, the Lost Lake Fire in June burned very close to Teesdale. I wasn't there at the height of the fire, but when I did return a couple of days later, it had been declared a Category 2 fire. There was a camp of 500-plus fire crews set up outside of Bicknell, and big helicopters brought in. I got to watch the deployment of those from my front porch, and it was a pretty amazing thing to see for someone who's not had a kind of a close experience with one of these fires. And compared to the acreage of some of the others, that wasn't all that big. I think it was about 2,000 acres.
Yeah, that's correct. That's a real big eye-opener if you've never seen an incident management team come into an area. It's almost like a little mini city in and of itself that is established in the area that the larger fires are burning in, and it's a really heavy logistical operation to support the firefighters and make sure that they have what they need to put the fires out and protect the communities. So I guess on that standpoint, we have Type 1 teams, which are actually even larger than a Type 2 team. And then the Type 2 team is they're equipped to handle fairly large incidents as well. And then we also have three or four local Type 3 teams within the state of Utah that are mobilized to handle incidents that escape the realm of initial attack. If they go for, if they burn for longer than one or two days, usually we'll bring in one of those Type 3 teams just to try to get some coordination and some overhead in place to make sure that we can get a quick handle on some of these fires before they turn into Type 2 or Type 1 fires.
If you missed the introduction, we're speaking with Nick Howell, who is with the BLM Color Country District Office, and we're talking about the wildfire season in Utah. And so, yes, one of the questions in the back of my mind was, how does this fire that's burning so close to where I am get categorized up to the 2 category? Because that, as you say, that really kicks in a lot of resources. Who makes that decision and based on what criteria?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. I'm glad you asked. We have what we call complexity analysis. And for every incident, a complexity analysis has to be done. And there's many contributing factors that go into that analysis and determine how complex the incident is. And a lot of that is based on the available vegetation that a specific fire has to burn. Another component to that is the proximity to urban areas or structures or homes. And then another component to it is drought and the dry conditions and the indices for the day and the projected weather forecast for a week or two ahead of the day that the fire actually started. And then another big component to that is how many of the local resources are going to be available to fight that fire. If there's multiple fires in the area, which there usually is in a typical fire season, especially in Utah, then sometimes the only way to get more resources to a fire is to order a Type 1 or a Type 2 team, and that becomes more of a priority than some of the smaller incidents that are being managed locally.
So I can see in the case of the Lost Lake Fire, there weren't a lot of local resources. This was burning in timber, very hot. There were structures threatened, and I guess those are some of the factors that contributed to that decision.
Yeah, those are some of the factors, especially up in the timber country. That's a little bit of a different animal, so to speak, than down on the BLM land and at the lower elevations where there's not that much vegetation. The fires usually move really quick and fast in the lower elevations, and it takes much longer. It takes many more days to suppress a fire in the timber country up in the national forest than it does out on the rangeland typically.
Because it's largely an air war.
Yeah, it is. The flame lengths are much higher, much taller, and it's a little more time-consuming in terms of what we call mop-up. That's basically securing the fire perimeter and making sure that all the hot spots are out. It's much more labor-intensive in that type of vegetation.
Is cost ever a concern?
Cost is always a concern. That's another component of the complexity analysis. Usually we try to handle things locally, and if that's not able to be done within the first operational shift or two, then we'll bring in one of those Type 3 teams, which is usually made up of interagency partners throughout the local areas within the state of Utah. And then if it escapes the Type 3 team's control, then if structures are damaged or even imminently threatened, we'll just, it all depends on what's in front of the fire and what the resource status is nationwide, other than statewide, that really helps us determine whether we're going to need a Type 1 team or a Type 2 team. But obviously the Type 1 or the Type 2 teams are going to be much more costly than your local units.
I saw a report, I don't have it in front of me, but the cost of flying just one of those helicopters is amazing.
Yeah, the heavy air tankers that drop the retardant and the helicopters is extremely expensive. Fire suppression is definitely not inexpensive, and it's a very costly thing. And it just depends on the aircraft contract and the retardant availability. A lot of times in a lot of months really dictates the cost, whatever's written into their contracts.
As you mentioned, we've got different agencies involved. There can be private land, state land, BLM land, and then generally at the higher elevations, Forest Service land. Bureaucracies can be sometimes very well defined, and I'm wondering how in these fire suppression efforts, you get around all the boundaries.
Yeah, the fire suppression world, or I guess I should say the fire management world, is kind of a different animal when you're looking at bureaucracies. And you're exactly right. There are some restrictions when it comes to the federal and the state government. And I think they're all done in the fire management arena with really good intentions. But really what it comes down to is all the agencies coming together, striving to meet a common goal, which is protecting the communities and serving the American public. And I think the federal government and the state government do that really well, but it takes everybody. It takes state agencies, federal agencies. You mentioned the aircraft. Most of those aircraft are tied to the federal government. So if the government did do something really well, I think fire suppression is it. It's a really well-coordinated effort, and it's very organized from the bottom all the way to the top.
One could imagine some very dramatic discussions taking place as officials review what's burning and what's critical and where people are threatened and where crews are available, and I don't know, something like a command post with maps and interactive things going on. Sounds like something they could make a TV show out of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting process if you've never been exposed to it. We have what we call command staff positions and general staff positions, which are made up of what is ultimately the incident command system. And interagency partners and agencies all throughout the nation are using that same system nationwide. And it's a really effective and organized way to manage fire suppression. And the military uses it as well to conduct large-scale military operations.
You think it'd make a good TV show?
I think it would, absolutely. I think there's a lot of interesting components to it and a lot of different things that take place behind the scenes that I don't think the average person has any idea about, really.
Again, in terms of the cost and the bills, I guess, although it's a concern, if you've got the situation that demands the fire control effort, whether it's a Category 2 or 1, people expect the bills will be paid later, and that's not something you worry about immediately.
Yeah, it's always a consideration that fire managers have when managing a wildfire, whether it's human-caused or lightning-caused. Cost is a huge component, especially with budgets being what they are. I guess another aspect of that is once a fire gets to a Type 1 complexity, there really is no other option than to order a Type 1 or a Type 2 team. We've even had fires that have been so complex that we've ordered in two Type 1 teams or two Type 2 teams for one specific fire. And oftentimes when a Type 1 team comes in, you're looking at close to $1 million a day to suppress that fire, especially if there's a lot of values or structures and communities at risk. It's definitely an expensive management program.
And if it is human caused, there will be an attempt to collect money from those responsible.
That's correct. If it's human caused, and negligence is always taken into account, but for the most part, all of the agencies do pursue cost recovery just because it is so expensive. And if the responsible party isn't held accountable for, their negligence or not doing their part to prevent the fire from starting in the first place, they will be held financially responsible. Otherwise, it just falls back on the rest of us taxpayers.
Yeah, most people are not going to be able to pay off a $3, $4, or $5 million bill.
Yeah, including some of the agencies. Just like I said, most of your larger fire suppression forces are federal firefighters. And, without that firefighting force, I think that nationwide we would have some challenges for sure.
Back to the Lost Lake fire again. I mentioned this was my first experience seeing this sort of thing deployed and strictly from the sidelines, not inside the scene. But apparently this system has been figured out because these people, the aircraft, arrived quickly. There was like a city set up, a big food service semis roll in. You've got a kitchen going full time, a parking area. And in the end, they were selling T-shirts.
Yeah. All of the caterers and most of the support units that are ordered to support these incidents are actually contracted through the general public. So local businesses and, businesses throughout the state and even other states in some instances have the opportunity to come in and support incidents that are of really large scale. And it's definitely one of those coordination efforts that we've got figured out. We do a lot of fire suppression every year, whether it's in Utah or another state. All of the federal resources are also national resources. So when they're not busy locally, they get sent to other states to help out with fire suppression. And it's something we do on a pretty frequent basis. And the process is definitely very streamlined and organized at this point. There's identified positions for every task and every support position that have to be in place to adequately protect the communities and support the firefighters on the ground.
Is it a challenge finding enough people to be hired to work the front lines of these fires?
It oftentimes is, especially with our reducing budgets. A lot of times we just don't have the resources locally to manage some of these fires that we have, especially this year specifically. There's been a lot of fires that we've had to bring in resources from outside the state. We've had a number of firefighters come in from California, from Oregon, from Nevada, from all over the place, all over the United States to help fight the firefighters here in Utah. So locally, we're spread pretty thin. We definitely don't have the capabilities to fight all the fires that we've had this year.
You mentioned earlier, and it's just a guess, but you think we've seen the worst of it this season?
Personally, I think we have, just because we've received a little bit of moisture, and the chances of the monsoons coming into the state is going to increase throughout July and probably throughout the first part of August. And really, that's what it all depends on, is the monsoonal moisture. If we receive a lot of precipitation with the monsoons, I think we'll be in really good shape in terms of reducing fire activity. If we get more lightning than precipitation, it could generate more fires. So We definitely have a lot of fire season left, and we're not out of the woods, but I think we have seen the worst of it.
Only one problem with bringing on the rain in a heavy monsoonal pattern. We've got a lot of areas that have been burned severely, and moisture hits that, and you've got mud and kind of a mess.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Oftentimes the moisture can bring more problems than the fire did in terms of erosion and causing mudslides and floods. And that's why any fire over 50 acres, at least on the federal side, is rehabilitated with seed in the fall and the wintertime. Usually we fly the seed on to a burn site to help stabilize that site as best we can. And usually we seed the area with an aircraft, either a helicopter or an airplane. And then we'll use two bulldozers to chain over the top of that area. And it brings back grasses and shrubs and restores the wildlife habitat much more quickly after a fire takes place. So and that's a whole other component that's it's definitely not a cheap financial cost to the agencies either, but it's equally as important than the fire suppression.
Yeah, I know a little area above Teasdale that's going to require some work.
Yeah, we've definitely don't have any shortage of rehabilitation opportunities this year, and that's going to be really critical to wildlife habitat and further protecting communities, because the last thing we want is for those areas to just fill up with cheatgrass and contribute to the fire load down the road.
That's what happens if you don't do anything, is it becomes cheatgrass.
Yeah, especially in the lower elevations, not so much over by Teasdale. It seems like the timber country rehabilitates a little bit, I guess, just differently than the rangeland does. But, fire is definitely a natural process, and the timber country actually responds quite well, and the new growth isn't as problematic up in the national forest. But down on the rangeland, we found that if we don't seed and rehabilitate a site, that we have a lot more problems with cheatgrass than if we do nothing and just let it come back on its own.
We'll have to leave it there. We're out of time, but very much appreciate you spending time to explain this for us. Nick Howell is with the Color Country Office at the Bureau of Land Management, joins us by phone. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for joining us on our Thursday edition of Access Utah. Filling in for Tom Williams this morning, I'm Lee Austin.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the new collection of Transcendent Songs from Richard Schindel and the latest traditional music release from the Carolina Chocolate Drops. I'll also play songs from new releases by Cindy Novello, Bruce Pioff, and Emma's Revolution, to name just a few. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.